Hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's episode of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. With you is Dr. Danya Koja. I'm an emergency physician on the East Coast of the United States, for now.
That's right. And I'm Wendy Chang, an emergency physician and neurointensivist in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we're going to be talking about the December 2021 issue of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine. And if you don't know what that is, what are you waiting for? It is ASAP's official CME publication. And each month, they have two lessons that cover the critical decisions that you need to know.
There are also a lot of other features, such as the critical image, critical cases in orthopedics and trauma, and as our listeners know, my favorite, the LLSA review.
So for our first lesson of this issue, it's fresh blood, massive transfusion protocols. Thank you to doctors Lisa Freeman and Jason Borlin for writing this article. You know what, Wendy? It's kind of crazy that we've been studying hemorrhage and coagulopathy for more than 50 years. And when you're trying to learn these coagulopathy cascades, it feels like it's way longer than 50 years to memorize even each one of them. But we still don't do as well as we can do, I think, and it still remains a significant cause of death.
Yeah, definitely. I think at least in the last 10 years or so, we have been more focused on this coagulopathy in trauma, which is a major contributor of these deaths. It occurs in a third of trauma patients by the time they reach the hospital, and two-thirds of those who do die of traumatic hemorrhages do so within the first 6 hours. And so there's still definitely room to improve on, for sure.
So we've always heard about the lethal triad in trauma: hypothermia, metabolic acidosis, and coagulopathy. So is there anything else other than this triad that contributes to that traumatic coagulopathy?
Yeah. So it all starts with definitely the tissue trauma itself and then the shock state with systemic hypoperfusions. That's what really sets it all off. And then what we do, unfortunately, can add to it: our hemodilution from our resuscitation, and then the hypothermia, that whether it's environmental or what we do, again, to the patients as we uncover them, and the acidemia all exacerbated. The important thing to know is that even if the patient doesn't have acute bleeding, this can still occur.
That's really interesting. And I don't think that we think about this often enough. Like, we think, oh, they're bleeding, they're going to become coagulopathic, but not, oh, they just had trauma and they're going to become coagulopathic even if they're not bleeding. So one thing you mentioned is that hemodilution from resuscitative efforts can actually worsen that coagulopathy. So should we just give people blood instead of the crystalloids? Is that going to fix that problem?
Yes, blood definitely is better than crystalloids since we're replacing what's bleeding out from the traumatic injuries. But I think the key point from this article is that we should give not just packed red blood cells, because just by giving packed red blood cells, that can also dilute the clotting factors. We actually want to try and mimic as physiologically close to whole blood as possible. So there's been two major studies, the PROMPT and the PROPER trials, that looked at timing, the sequence, and the ratio of blood products that we use in resuscitation. And they found that 1:1:1 of plasma to platelets to RBCs had lower exsanguination and better hemostasis. And of course, as we already alluded to, early and higher crystalloid use was associated with higher mortality.
So does every trauma patient need this 1:1:1 resuscitation?
Well, I think this is more so targeted at those who are coming in, obviously sicker, right? And so if you are finding yourself giving multiple red blood cells for any sort of bleeding patient, you should also ask yourself at some point, do I need to consider this, let's say, epistaxis patient or GI bleeder also need plasma and platelets to have a more balanced resuscitation? But specifically, since we're talking about trauma, some institutions have massive transfusion protocols for patients who are severely hemorrhaging that rapidly provides this ratio-based resuscitations. So essentially, your blood bank is going to get this notice that you want to activate a massive transfusion protocol. They quickly prepare a whole cooler full of blood products, again, red cells, plasma, and platelets, so that you can have it at bedside and administer that quickly. And then they'll continue to give you coolers full of blood until hopefully your patient gets better. The PROMPT trial actually showed that if two or more of these triggers are present, it is 85% sensitive for a patient needing a massive transfusion protocol. And so these triggers are if they're tachycardic with heart rate greater than or equal to 120, if they're hypotensive, systolic less than 90, if they have a positive FAST exam, if they have a penetrating mechanism, and then if you have labs back that show your hemoglobin is less than 11, INR is greater than 1.5, or a base deficit greater than or equal to 6. Essentially, again, patients who are coming in sick, unstable. The authors also provided their institution's massive transfusion protocol that you can take a look at.
I think you need some tea, Wendy.
Tea? I need more coffee. I'm only halfway through. And you think I need tea? Well, I have a bigger tea and a smaller coffee.
You need something. You need a massive caffeine transfusion.
I know. Damn sleep these days.
Got it. So those are some great tips for us to recognize who are these sicker patients, or actually put like some more of a concrete definition to that. So let's say we define these patients and we start this massive transfusion protocol. How long do we keep up this like ratio-based resuscitation for?
Right. So after this patient rolls in, they're unstable, you do this initial resuscitation. At some point, you should send some lab work to kind of see what you're dealing with and reassess, obviously, how the patient is doing. And this is where we're getting into more goal-directed resuscitation and using some dynamic hemostatic assays as your endpoints. There are several that can be used. Our listeners might be familiar with thromboelastography or TEG, a rapid TEG, or even rotational thromboelastometry, ROTEM. The article really focuses on rapid TEG, but they're similar all in concept. Essentially, they're measuring the patient's ability to form a clot and then how it breaks down. It's better than traditional coagulation studies because, again, it's a dynamic assessment. This can change throughout the patient's course, and it can differentiate more than just whether or not there's a coagulopathy there. It can actually show you if there's hypercoagulopathy there, if there's hyperfibrinolysis, if there's a fibrinogen deficiency or a platelet deficiency. Again, there are some really great tables and figures in the article that really explains what a rapid TEG is and the author's institutional treatment algorithm. Great references. It's always good to pull one of these up when you're dealing with a patient who needs a TEG. But another important thing to remember is that these don't measure platelet inhibition, such as with patients who are taking aspirin or clopidogrel.
That's definitely a great tip and a great reminder. So let's move on to TXA, which I suspect is something that you like to talk about. Yep, all that smiling, Wendy. So what about it? When do we use it?
I mean, we use TXA for everything in the ED, right?
No, I thought that was midazolam that we use for everything, isn't it?
That's true. That's true. I need a little hip pack with TXA and midazolam.
That'd be amazing.
Yes. So TXA, or tranexamic acid, is an antifibrinolytic, and it helps stabilize the clot that you want to form in a bleeding patient and prevents the clot being lysed and causing worsening coagulopathy. It certainly has been shown to decrease bleeding and the need for transfusion in many settings, surgical settings included. So the CRASH II trial looked at TXA in traumatic hemorrhagic shock, and they found that patients who received it early, less than 3 hours post-injury, had lower mortality. So we should consider it in patients who have on their rapid TEG evidence of hyperfibrinolysis, which is if their LY30 is greater than 3%, if they're needing ongoing transfusion, and even with the recent International Trauma Life Support Position paper, they suggested that maybe this should be considered in the pre-hospital setting.
Got it. So this is such a fantastic review on massive transfusion protocols and what to do when people are bleeding quite a lot. So thank you, Wendy, for taking us through this article. This was a great reminder that people can have coagulopathy even if they're not acutely bleeding. Definite reminder that crystalloids are not the way to go. If someone needs something, then 1:1:1 of plasma platelets and RBCs, which basically is to mimic whole blood as much as possible, in sicker patients who need basically volume. You did share with us some indicators for how we can identify those patients that are sicker from the PROMPT trial. So things like tachycardia, hypotension, positive fast, low hemoglobin, elevated INR, base deficit, a penetrating mechanism, and definitely a great reminder of using rapid TEG rather than looking at traditional coagulopathy parameters, because that can identify hyper and hypocoagulable states, hyperfibrinolysis, and things like that. However, it does not show us when there's platelet inhibition from things like antiplatelets like aspirin or anything like that. And then finally, last but not least, TXA is there. May be used if less than 3 hours post-injury, especially if someone has an ongoing transfusion requirement, they're breathing a lot. And you know what? Maybe pretty soon we're going to be starting using it in the pre-hospital arena.
Excellent.
So keeping up with trauma, we're going to talk about critical cases in orthopedics and trauma, which is a case of septic arthritis of the ankle.
Yes. The case describes a patient who actually had a pressure ulcer on the heel and presenting with what looked like an abscess. And so if you do suspect septic arthritis of the ankle, the gold standard, of course, is doing an arthrocentesis. A common myth or a popular belief is that we can't aspirate through an area of cellulitis because that would then cause septic arthritis in a sterile joint. But the authors share that there's actually no real evidence for that.
That's definitely a myth that has been painfully repeated over and over and over again. And in a case like this, for example, it almost prevented them from getting into the real diagnosis. And the article does talk about how to perform an ankle arthrocentesis in detail, which is not something that we do often, so definitely worth a review. We can either do it from the anterior approach, which is through the tibiotalar joint with the foot like dorsiflexed, or posterior. And of course, if you have an ultrasound, then use it.
Yes. And in terms of your antibiotic coverage, you do want to cover for gram positives like staph and strep. And then if the patient is immunocompromised, don't forget about gram negative coverage too. Now moving on to our critical procedure of this month, we're talking about reduction of a lateral patellar dislocation, which I think we just straighten the leg or extend the knee.
Yep. Sounds pretty much it. And then just apply some medial pressure to that patella, lifting the patella over the femoral condyle, and then, pop, it should go back in place. If it does not happen that easily, do not force it. If it's not reducing, maybe you don't have the right diagnosis. So just stop what you're doing, call a consultant, and proceed that way.
Good reminder. Our critical EKG this month is a patient who has a STEMI and is a great reminder that contiguous leads on the body are not necessarily contiguous on our EKG paper.
Exactly. So 1 and AVL are next to each other on our body, as are 3 and AVF. So moving on to our critical image this month, this is an interesting case of severe abdominal pain in a patient who has a history of an endovascular stent grafting of an abdominal aortic aneurysm.
Ooh, I know. Patient must have an aortoenteric fistula. That's the board question to everything bad that happens with patients after AAA repair.
Exactly. And that's actually also the answer in this case. And this case reminds us of the fact that it's important to think of, although it's pretty rare, but it can be pretty bad because if you're bleeding from something connected to your aorta, that does not sound good. The most important pearl is that these patients need IV contrast, but no oral contrast, because that can actually obscure the images and make them harder to interpret. The imaging that you would need for these patients is arterial phase images followed by like delayed images. And some of the findings that people might have for an aortic fistula or graft infection can be expected in the post-op period. And this article goes into those details. So knowing the timeline since the repair is definitely important. As always, the critical image is great. All of the images in that article and the pearls.
Great points.
So for the LLSA review this month, we have ruling out subarachnoid hemorrhage. And today we're reviewing the ASAP clinical policy, which was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2019 on critical issues in the evaluation and management of adult patients presenting to the emergency department with acute headache, which is an update of the 2008 policy.
That's right. So the policy discusses four critical questions. How do you risk stratify patients coming in with a headache that you're concerned about subarachnoid hemorrhage? What diagnostic testing should be done? And pain management for primary headache, which are all very common questions in ED for sure.
All right, so let's get started. I'm sure you're incredibly excited to talk about this, Wendy.
Yes.
It's an LSA review and a neurotopic. So let's get going. How are we supposed to risk stratify people for subarachnoid hemorrhage?
Well, I think all of us have probably heard about the Ottawa subarachnoid rule, and it is 100% sensitive to rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage if a patient does not have the criteria such as neck pain or stiffness, if they're not greater than or equal to 40 years old, so that means if they're younger, if they have not had a witness loss of consciousness, it did not occur during exertion, the headache is not thunderclap in quality, and they do not have limited neck flexion on exam. So a lot of negatives in that, but essentially you want to make sure the patient does not have any of these red flag type of presentations. It is important to remember that it has poor specificity, so many patients will still get a workup and that may end up being negative.
Exactly, and that's a reminder that these rules are not there for us to diagnose these diseases, but rather to rule them out and figure out who our super low-risk patients are. So let's say we suspect subarachnoid hemorrhage. Is it enough if we just do a negative dry CT within 6 hours to rule out a subarachnoid? There was a lot of talk about that.
Yeah. I think we can pretty confidently say that it can be the case now. It's a level B recommendation, and it deals with if you have third generation and at least 4 slice CT scanners, which I think most of us all have now since this has been since the late 1990s. And the patient should not have neurodeficits, history of subarachnoid hemorrhage, findings of papilledema, ventricular shunts, or brain neoplasms.
So let's say you did a CT and it was negative, but it wasn't within 6 hours, or the patient was high risk, and you basically needed an extra workup. Would you use a CTA instead of LP for these patients?
You could, but the key take home from this question is that there is limited evidence directly comparing LP versus CTA as kind of your next step in your workup of patients that you have high suspicion for subarachnoid hemorrhage. So the ASEP policy recommends to do some shared decision-making with your patients to consider kind of the risk-benefit of both approaches.
All right, so let's switch gears to non-subarachnoid hemorrhage headache topics. For pain management of someone coming in with a primary headache, do you give an opioid or not?
I think there's been lots of evidence that opioids do not offer superior pain management. So no, and this is actually a level A recommendation. The policy does go into details about other medications that have been studied, but doesn't make a particular recommendation about any specific one. But it also highlights a very important point again, that if a patient does get some relief in response to your analgesia, it does not suggest that the cause of their headache is benign.
That's definitely a helpful review of common questions that come up in the ED and a pretty helpful clinical policy. So moving on to our clinical pediatrics, it's a case of isolated fallopian tube torsion, which is not even a diagnosis I knew existed. So apparently patients present with belly pain, nausea, vomiting, and basically everything you think of when you think of appendicitis or ovarian torsion or, you know, in an older individual, maybe PID. So what's that about?
Yeah, it's new to me too. But simply, these are patients who present looking like they have an ovarian torsion, but ultimately their workup imaging shows a normal ovary with or without a paraovarian mass or cyst on the ultrasound. It's the same concept. It's an unhealthy fallopian tube of some reason. Maybe they have intrinsic tubal pathology, endometriosis, neoplasm, or like you mentioned, PID, and it twists on itself. And the treatment is the same as well. You want to take the patient to the OR to prevent necrosis, detours it, and if it's not salvageable, unfortunately, salpingectomy.
Great review of a rare disease, but something that we need to think about in our differential for ovarian torsion where the ovary is fine. And this is a great segue for our second lesson, which is entitled The Masquerader, Pediatric Appendicitis. Thank you to Dr. Shivani Mehta, Robert Lapis, and Irma Ugalde for writing this article. Appendicitis is the most common abdominal surgical emergency in children, most common in 10 to 19-year-olds. And this is not something that's usually diagnosed within the first 24 hours, especially in younger kids, which increases their complications.
It is tough, for sure. The differential is so large.
Yep, and there's a great table in the article that summarizes quite a lot of them. I think the most important thing to remember is that we need to think of the diagnosis, and then we can try to look for it. Because apparently it's initially missed in 30 to 60% of children overall in the first visit, and it's missed in almost 100% of those who are 2 years or younger on their first visit, which is a very scary statistic. It's making me not want to even look at a two-year-old, like even if they're not in the ER.
That's right. So we typically think about appendicitis as somebody coming in with right lower quadrant pain, nausea, vomiting, fever, and loss of appetite. Does that still hold true in kids?
This article has some great data on that. In pediatric patients with abdominal pain, the presence of pain migrating to the right lower quadrant is 46% sensitive and 90% specific for appendicitis. However, there's quite a few people who are not going to have any belly pain. And in those, fever is the most sensitive and specific at around 75% for both. Anorexia is around 68% sensitive and 64% specific. And nausea and vomiting is the least helpful of those, with a sensitivity of 75%, but a specificity of only 54%.
Oof. Okay. Then what about the physical exam?
So we often do the Rovsing sign where you have right lower quadrant pain when you palpate the left lower quadrant, or look for the psoas sign when you have the right lower quadrant pain with right hip flexion. And we do these in adults. But in kids, the most reliable sign is actually pain with coughing or hopping, with a sensitivity of 72% and specificity of 91%. The second most reliable sign is just simply right lower quadrant tenderness, with a sensitivity of 79% and specificity of 83%. Of course, if somebody has a surgical abdomen like guarding and rebound, it's concerning. It doesn't really matter what's the cause, to be honest. Call a surgeon. But it's definitely worth remembering that GU exams are an essential part of your belly exam, especially in young boys with referred testicular pain, and that sometimes your answer is in serial belly exams, not in just the first one. The article also adds a fantastic pearl, which is that being on antibiotics, whether it's for a different reason, like the misdiagnosis that was the first one, like your pharyngitis apparently, or if a person is on antibiotics because they had like presumed appendicitis before they were transferred to your hospital, that may alter the abdominal exam and make it just less impressive and less significant. So keep that in mind.
Getting tougher and tougher. All right, then what about labs? Can they help us with the diagnosis?
Well, yes and no. Leukocytosis and neutrophilia are pretty sensitive at 95 and 80%, but only within the first 24 hours of symptom onset. CRP is very sensitive at 97.9%, but that's a day four. However, if you combine these three predictors, you have a 98.7% negative predictive value regardless of the duration of the illness. And that may help with the diagnosis.
Okay. Some positive.
Negative. Some positive negative predictive value.
Some promising tools.
All right, promising. Yes, let's call it promising.
So this is a great segue then to talk about clinical decision rules, such as the Alvarado and pediatric appendicitis score. Can we use those to risk stratify patients?
That's a great question. These tools look at more than just a lab test. They look at like migration of pain, anorexia, nausea, right lower quadrant tenderness, rebound tenderness, fever, leukocytosis, neutrophilia. And each of these scores has a slightly different ratings for these items and then how you decide who's low risk, medium risk, and high risk. But theoretically, that would help you determine the pretest probability of appendicitis. Problem is that validation studies have shown that the Alvarado has a sensitivity somewhere between 70 to 90% and specificity of 60 to 80, whereas the pediatric appendicitis score has a sensitivity of around 85% and specificity between 50 to 65%. Therefore, neither is sufficient on its own to confirm the diagnosis or sensitive enough to rule it out in your low-risk patients.
Okay, two thumbs down.
Wah, wah.
Then imaging, that must be our ticket to this.
Well, ultrasound is our number one tool. And there are quite a few diagnostic indicators. So if the appendix is more than 6 to 9 millimeters in diameter, if it's not compressible, and if you have tenderness when you squish the appendix. Of course, if there's free fluid or an appendiceal fecalith, then you can suspect a ruptured or perforated appendix. And the fantastic news is that it's pretty sensitive and specific, even as a point of care ultrasound in the emergency department.
Woo-hoo.
I know, right? Your sensitivity is around 86%. And the specificity is 91%, which is pretty good. So basically, that particular paper said, you know what? If you see it in the ED, you don't need to get another test. You're pretty good at this. It's pretty specific. Keep moving forward. The issue, though, with ultrasound is that sometimes you're not going to be able to see that appendix, either because it's retrocecal and it's hiding from you, or that the person has so much bowel gas, you can't just get it out of the way. If that's the case, then it's either a CT, or if you have access to that, preferably something called a fast protocol MRI. And there's actually been a study that shows that in patients who get an ultrasound and then a fast protocol MRI, obviously in places that are used to doing this, it does not cause a delay of the diagnosis in comparison to just heading to CT right away. So definitely a thought.
Oh, very cool. All right, you mentioned that this is a very tough diagnosis to make in young children, very small children, since they're missed 100% of the time. So any special tips for these kids?
Well, the good news is that it's much less common in that particular age group. And the not so good news is that most of the kids less than 3 years old are only diagnosed after perforation. Usually it's because they can't really tell you much. And also they present atypically. The most common presentation in that child who's less than 3 years old is going to be vomiting, fever, and diarrhea. Who does not have that? And that's why.
Of all ages.
Well, especially little kids. That's true. Go to daycare and I don't know, they lick the floor. I don't know what they do at daycare. Okay. But everybody has fever, vomiting, and diarrhea. So a couple of pointers that this is something else other than just good old gastro is if they have pain while they're walking, if they are limping, and if they have abdominal distension, that's pretty specific as well. So your gastro in less than a three-year-old, just ask yourself one more time, are you sure this is just gastro?
Oh man, expanding the differential for the limping kid now. All right. What about overweight and obese children? Any special considerations?
So interestingly, CRP may be falsely positive in children who are overweight. In addition, the appendix may not be visualized on ultrasound, just logistically speaking, and these patients may require more CTs. The other interesting thing is that overweight children may have a false positive finding on the ultrasound when you look at the appendix. So these kids end up either getting more CTs or going to the OR for appendectomies of normal appendices. Is it still called appendices? All right, so for normal appendices. So one way to minimize all of these unnecessary tests and laparotomies in kids is to observe them, do serial abdominal exams, and re-image them with the ultrasound at different intervals.
Got it. These have been some great tips so far. Let's say we are on a roll and we diagnose it and the surgeon's on the way. What else do we need to do?
Well, the number one thing we need to think of is antibiotics. A broad-spectrum antibiotic upon diagnosis and another dose 30 to 60 minutes before surgery has been shown to decrease the risk of infection and post-op abscess. So definitely something that we need to do ASAP. The other thing is that especially with kiddos who are having some vomiting, diarrhea, and so on, they can be dehydrated. So they need to be treated with IV fluids. Just start with your usual 20 cc's per kilo and take it from there, and then start them on maintenance fluid whenever you're done with that piece. Pain management is also pretty important, whether you start with something as simple as acetaminophen, a non-steroidal, or you end up giving them an opioid. These do not mask the symptoms or delay the diagnosis, so we don't need to keep the kid miserable until they're seen by the surgeon.
Got it. All right. And then we're done?
Well, almost. There's still one more thing. Not all patients with appendicitis are going to require surgery. Non-op management of appendicitis has becoming more and more popular and can actually be considered for patients who have acute, non-complicated appendicitis, and is actually successful in 97% of cases with a 14% recurrence rate. If patients are high risk, then this is not for them. High risk for perforation basically means symptoms for 2 or more days, their fever is 38 Celsius or more, they have free fluid on ultrasound, or their appendix diameter is more than 9.7 millimeters. those are not your antibiotic candidates. Those are high risk for complications, and these need to go to the OR. If they don't have any of these, you may want to consider admitting them in the hospital for IV antibiotics and observation.
Well, thank you, Danya, for taking us through this lesson. There's been lots of pearls, especially for a disease that is indeed the great masquerader. I think it's important to think of the diagnosis, as you mentioned, because it is initially missed in a lot of children, and we have to know the limitations of the presenting symptoms, physical exam, even our diagnostic testing. Migrating pain to the right lower quadrant, and if the patient has pain with coughing or hopping on their feet, are better clues to appendicitis in children. Whereas lab tests, imaging, clinical decision rules all on their own may not be as helpful. Point of ear ultrasound is our friend, as it is with a lot of our disease processes, but it's actually quite great to hear that the sensitivity and specificity is quite high if you are able to find a dilated appendix that's non-compressible or even tenderness over the appendix. And then if you do make this diagnosis in the ED, don't forget about antibiotics when you make the diagnosis and another dose 30 to 60 minutes before surgery, since that can decrease the risk of infection and post-op abscess, as well as all the other supportive care like hydration and pain management. But at the same time, not every patient will need surgery. And so non-op management of appendicitis are becoming more popular and successful. So definitely take a look at this article for more pearls.
And hopefully appendicitis is not going to keep masquerading from us so much.
That's right.
And speaking of taking care of the pain in patients with appendicitis, our drug box this month is about intravenous acetaminophen.
Yeah, we're all familiar with acetaminophen, so there's not much to talk about here. Although in the IV form, it is more expensive. And so that's probably why we don't get to use it as much in the ED in most places. There is news that maybe generic versions are due to be released soon, so maybe we will have better access to this. And there are also some conflicting reports of some patients that are critically ill experiencing transient drops in blood pressure with this administration.
Hopefully coming in a cheap way to an ED near you.
That's right.
So finally, last but not least, the ToxBox this month is citalopram overdose, which is an SSRI marketed for less cardiotoxic effects than other antidepressants, but not when they're overdosing. And an overdose is just as terrible. It has a high bioavailability, and it peaks around 4 hours after ingestion with a half-life of 35 hours and even longer than that in overdose. So forever. Well, not really forever, but really long time. It can cause sedation, seizures, QT prolongation, and torsades from its inhibition of the potassium and calcium channels, and also acidosis and hypokalemia. These patients may need pressors because of how hypotensive they become and may even be candidates for ECMO if they have refractory shock. Don't forget that if they go into serotonin syndrome, cyproheptadine may be a good option. If they're completely asymptomatic, just watch them for 12 hours or so, and then you can discharge them.
Good to know.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for taking the time to go through this issue with me. I learned a lot from all of the lessons and the LLSA review. Our dear listeners, we hope that you've enjoyed listening to us as much as we've enjoyed recording this.
We hope that you find the Critical Decisions publication and our podcast always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
We'd love to hear from you on our social media accounts on Twitter. My handle is at Danya Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC.
And until next month.
Bye-bye.
Well, actually, until next year.
That's right. We're almost there. See you next year.
Bye-bye.